Welcome to Keep the Hotel Empty. Today we have kept the hotel empty for the host of the show, Eric Paul. Eric, welcome.
Oh my God, welcome to my other side.
That's right. This is the second time you've been on the other side, but probably the first time people are going to see you on this side.
Right.
So you are a fan of saying that a lot of the reason you're able to do this, and you know, usually when people say you're very good at this, you respond this way. You say that you're just genuinely curious. And I really, really like that. So I kind of want to go back. At what point in your life do you think that genuine curiosity is born? And when does it become something that you see as an asset?
That's a very good question. Much like the very first time that we did the opposite swap interview, the one that will be in the B-side, you know, for the Ultra Patreon someday.
Yeah, we'll release it in like 15 years. Yeah. It's in the vault for now.
Yeah. It's very hard to talk about anything as it relates to my personality, my perceptions of the world, or anything that I've done professionally without having to disclose right out of the gate my visual impairment. It's not something that I talk about very often. It's never something that I mention to people upon meeting them. I almost always wait till they see me reading, or it's something like, I think all the lights are blue and they're pink. you know, because I've had my visual impairment my whole life, it's not always the first thing I think of when I'm relating to other people. So as that relates to my curiosity, I think it is a little bit just as plain as that. What everyone else sees, I don't see. And that's always been the case. So for me to try to figure out who's who in the zoo or how this all fits together, I have to try to dig for something that isn't so obvious. The thing that makes it so most people can avoid being curious is, or I shouldn't say avoid it, but not necessarily have to lean on it as much as I have, is whatever the fuck is up, they can see it plain as day. There's a red car coming this way. I don't know that it's red or it's a car or it's coming until it's way too damn close. So I had to start seeing the world in a different way to try to get myself to be able to at least be on some of the same page that everyone else could be at, like, instantly. So that was like what it was like when I was much younger. But I can tell you, I realized that my curiosity, which is rooted in my upbringing and the kind of person that I would be anyways, I think it was just supercharged by my disability. My curiosity really bloomed when I was maybe like 7 or 8 years old, and my parents were just divorced. And my mom could start to have some of the things around the house that she liked to have around. We lived in this place that was like a cabin. It wasn't meant to be lived in 365, but we got to live there and whatever. But she got to decorate this little lake housey cabin thing the way she wanted it. And one of the things that she got that wouldn't have flown when my parents were married was like this picture of like this black cat, but it was really abstract. And it hung above the phone in the kitchen. And this is the first time I've really been in any kind of environment that my mom can curate sans my dad's approval, right? So I'm starting to see some of the things around that reflect my mom more. And this black cat thing is the first thing. And I'm looking at this picture and I'm like, I understand it's supposed to be a cat, but this is not like, it's not a cat. It's supposed to be a cat, but it's not a cat. And this is really causing me cognitive dissonance as a child. And I'm very curious. And I say to my mom, what is up with this picture of this black cat? And she's like, it's abstract art. And it was like the fucking universe just froze. And I will never, ever forget it. And I recently told her about this. She said abstract art, and my mind just went poof. And it was like, oh, you can be a cat, but you don't have to be a cat? And it was like, okay, this is the bottomless pit of curiosity right here. Nothing is as it seems. And even the things that are supposed to seem like something can seem totally different and still represent that thing. So it was like this Pandora's box that nothing is ever what it seems, even when it seems like it is what it seems.
Yeah.
And it became immensely empowering for me because I realized that those real, I don't know if you want to call them truths or intriguing flavors in life, they all lied in the things that everybody couldn't see. Yeah. So I was at no disadvantage there. And that's when I saw it as an advantage. It was like, oh shit, I can get good at this thing that no one else is paying attention to because there's a whole bounty of things here that are below the surface. And I'm just as equipped to find and see those things as anybody else. So I started honing in on that, like, I swear to God, from that moment on. And my mom is very idealistic, very artistic. My parents are diametrically opposed in a lot of ways, but both of them are creative thinkers. So, you know, I realized that the curiosity and being able to look beneath the surface was going to be the super fuel for creative thinking, and it just set me free.
Yeah. Did you have a feeling when that sunk in for you, that in a way, like, I guess your disability allowed you to see the world not as the cat, but as the abstract cat.
I couldn't see the cat. I had no choice. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. So I'm kind of curious, and this is a slight tangent. You know, I was not born with any kind of disability in that way. Definitely different ways of thinking, but I didn't realize that the way that my brain worked was so different from anybody else's until I started to socialize with larger groups of people and seeing how the more standardized way of thinking is, or how I'm expected to think about things. What was the first moment that you kind of realized that you saw things differently than other people?
There was never a moment where I didn't feel that way.
Mm.
My disability, especially in the early 80s, you know, I was very much odd man out. Very, very, very much odd man out. And part of the backbone of that story, and I really don't talk about my disability too much because I don't let it, it doesn't really affect what I'm capable of. And it never really has, other than I don't drive and I can't see colors and shit like that. But I've never really felt too limited by it in the things that I wanted to be good at.
Yeah. And on a side note, too, I'll also say that that's so true. I often forget that you have this vision impairment.
I'm really grateful for that.
Yeah.
When people that are close to me tell me that, that makes me feel good.
Yeah.
It might be plasticky or whatever, but that does make me feel good.
Yeah. I think there was one time I asked if you would want to drive or take the wheel.
Yeah.
And it was like well into our friendship. And I was like, oh my gosh.
No.
Yeah.
But part of the thing for me is, it seems like growing up in the early 80s and 90s in Wisconsin was like 100 years ago in a different country compared to now.
Yeah.
And my mom was faced or given an option before I went into regular public school. I had like preschool and stuff. But before I went into regular public school, there was a, you know, my eye doctors and a certain group of people that had strongly suggested that she send me to a school for the blind and that I would be able to, you know, have I have no other way to put it other than my own frame of reference, that I'd have a path of less resistance.
Yeah.
This was not necessarily something that my mom saw as a thing that would be advantageous to me.
Right.
She was more of the mind frame that if you put him with no challenge and he succeeds, then how is he supposed to grow?
Mm-hmm.
He's not disabled in any other way other than his vision. So as long as they can accommodate that part in a traditional public school, then he can just be with everybody else and run the same clip as everybody else. So, you know, a big reason why I try not to let my disability be anything that really gets in the way of anything. And I try to look at it as more my way to find my way through things is because I've always been in an environment where it was geared towards able-bodied people.
Yeah.
Everything. Everything. You know, I mean, when I first went to college, I had been in recording studios for nearly 7 years at that point. My dad had a couple studios. I was well into being a musician at that point. I was working in a movie theater. Here's the irony of being the disabled guy. I'm a projectionist at a movie theater, and I've now learned to sit up in the projection booth and look at the screen, and if it's a certain degree looking out of focus to me, then I know that's probably in focus.
Mm-hmm.
And in the beginning, I narrowed that down by getting the film running, booking ass from the projection booth all the way into the theaters. I only had two theaters I had to run at that point. All the way into the theaters, I'd walk all the way to the front of the entire theater, look up at the screen like this where I could see it, where I was close enough to see it. I could see if it was in focus or not, and then I'd book all the way ass up back upstairs and tweak it just a little bit until I learned that. So I was well into my life. I was a performing musician with my best friends.
Mm-hmm.
I had a steady job at a family business I had been at for nearly 7 years. I could have worked at till all the live long day. And life was good. And I had studio experience. My dad had an engineer called Mark Goldie. Shout out Mark Goldie. He's got a studio in Appleton called The Rock Garden. The man was an old school genius, taught me things that I carried with me through my entire career because I was one of these kids, unlike you, in that I straddled the birth of all this technology. So mm-hmm. I came up in recording studios with ADAT machines and analog boards and all this crap. And then by the time I got to college, it was all digital stuff. So here's where I'm going to tie this story of my disability together. When I'm very first in college, we have an SSL desk, and I'm in love with this thing. I could just sleep next to it, underneath it, whatever. An SSL, a big standard recording console, right?
Right.
And but I can't see the fucking knobs. I can't see any of the numbers along the knobs. I can see what sections they're divvied up into, you know, the bus matrix at the top and, you know, the compression and the EQ. And, you know, I know what sections they're broken up into, but I don't know what the knobs are, right? And one of the very first things they had us do was just compress a snare drum. They were just playing some snare drum back from a 2-inch tape, which alone was like the coolest thing, you know. There's 2-inch tape reeling in the room next to me. I'm just on cloud nine, right? So the fact that I can't see this isn't really freaking me out because I'm too goddamn excited. And they get me up to the console and they're playing the snare drum back and they're like, hey, you know, we want you to shave off the transients of the snare drum and just make it nice and fat. And so it was basically just shave down the peaks and make it so it sustains a little bit more, okay? Pretty easy peasy, but they wanted it at a 4-to-1 and whatever to make sure that we were knowing how to turn the shit to achieve the goal, right? So they gave us the numbers in the beginning, which you could see on the knobs to try to get us to associate what you see with what you hear, because some people will start to mix with their eyes.
Yeah.
I don't have that option.
Right.
So when they first put me in front of the console, I would just face the speakers and turn the knobs until I heard it sounding like what they wanted me to do. And they both looked at me and they were like, okay, that sounds good. How did you do that? And I was like, I just listened to it. So that was one of the first, I would say that was the second time that I knew my visual disability was not going to hold me back in the audio world, because what everyone else was using visually, I just sheerly found a way to not need. Not that it couldn't have been advantageous for me. I just found a way to not need it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the ethos from my first day in public school all the way to college. The apparatus that was set up for everybody to get molded through just wouldn't work for me. It just couldn't work for me.
Yeah.
So I had to find the way and just get mines and move on through.
Yeah. And in a way, having to do that, you know, you're already a step ahead of everybody else in this particular regard, of course.
Yeah, well, I mean, I had, you know, I was, like I said, I was grateful to have experience in recording studios before I got there. So I knew that trusting your ears was a reasonable thing to do. And that was part of the reason why I was there. You know, my dad kind of gave me a shit to get off the pot moment. He's like, well, do you just want to stay in our little hometown and just manage the movie theater and do this all the rest of your life? Or are you going to do something? It was like, well, I was just going to stay here and kick it. I was like, I guess it hadn't occurred to me. And he's like, well, you know, and within 3 months of that, I was in college.
Yeah. Well, and that's, I think, you know, going back to our last episode, it's easy to fall into that groove. And I called it like the small mind. And I think, you know, one thing I've always admired about you and something that, you know, we connected on instantly, which you talked about a lot in the last portion was, you know, being genuinely outside of the box in your thinking. So I'm curious, you know, obviously your eyesight and your disability has led you to just automatically have to think outside of the box.
It's like a reflex for me to look for the other thing.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, this slight tangent, we'll bring it back. But I was thinking about you the other day because I was in my jiu-jitsu class and we're learning this move basically when somebody tries to get mount, right? When someone tries to get on top of you and get a dominant position, there's a very small window where all their weight is shifted to one leg and you can bump them and wrap your legs around theirs and trap them, right? Mm-hmm. And they told us, close your eyes while you're learning this so you can feel for the moment when the weight shifts. And I instantly thought of you because I imagine, you know, a lot of your life is like that. You're one step ahead there because, you know, everyone in class was having a hard time with it because they're trying to see when it happens. Because that's the first thing that people usually use is what they see.
We're the only animal that does that.
Yeah.
We're the only animal that goes, our hierarchy of input from our senses is vision first.
Yeah. So I'm curious. So what, first things first, what age did you get into public school? Was it kind of normal
right
for you?
Right out of the gate, yeah.
Yeah, right out of the gate. Okay. Yeah. So you're now entering a world where you are operating, you know, everything is standardized, like you said. And this is before technology where accessibility is a big deal.
Dude.
And, you know, another slight tangent here. You know how I talk.
Yeah.
One of the first things that tipped me off, because I didn't immediately know about your eyesight disability, but one of the first things that tipped me off was you had your phone set with the text this big, and you're still, you know, reading it like this.
That's what I say. Usually, yeah. I got to wait for someone to see me read.
Yeah, so you're growing up in a world without that. And
oh, my God.
So you step into this space now where there's a competitiveness to it. You're graded. You know, by all means, and, you know, because of the direction of your mother, you know, you're expected to for lack of a better word, compete compete amongst people who don't have this, right?
Exactly.
What are some of the first moments where you start to realize you need to do this in a different way? And what are some of the things that you start to latch on to? What are some of the skills that you developed early on?
Oh, man. It was rough. It was rough out of the gate, no question about it. But it isn't a poor me, and I didn't spend very much time feeling that way. And that's a big one. Shout out to my mom and all the moms out there giving their kids self-assuredness.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was something I got at a very early age. That was the skill I learned first. What are you going to do? Feel bad about yourself, and then what? You know, what are you going to do, get angry? I remember, elementary school was rough. It was, you know, getting soccer balls in the face and, you know, shit like that. Just like those types of things. And it was almost,
I imagine dodgeball wasn't your forte.
It was almost just like I wasn't there to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got to middle school, I had my contacts. So people couldn't, because this was now the early 90s, and they were able to make a contact lens for me that's a lens inside of a lens, which I still wear to this day. And my glasses are for my double vision. But when I first got into middle school, I was then around a bunch of kids that didn't know me, and they didn't know immediately that I couldn't see.
Mm-hmm.
So the skill that I kind of developed at that point was to kind of to homogenize myself, to not let the cat out of the bag.
Mm-hmm.
And the ways that I guess I learned to compete, for no other way to put it, was just to make sure I was fucking listening. That's all I had. Because, you know, they used to try to say, oh, we'll sit Eric in the front of the class. Man, I don't care if I'm in the damn front of the class. 3 feet away, I might as well be 300 feet away. It makes no difference. I can't, unless I'm literally face-to-face with the board, it makes no difference. So by that, by the time I could advocate for myself to the degree that I could articulate that sentiment clearly enough that the adults couldn't argue with me. That's one of the other skills that I learned very quick for, was to advocate for myself, because the adults couldn't understand what was going on in my world at all. Unless I could articulate it very clearly with little to no room for interpretation on the other end, chances are I was going to get fucking marginalized in some way.
Yeah, I remember what comes to mind there is the story you told me about the teacher who thought he could teach you not to be colorblind.
Yeah, and this was middle school, and that was a great one. And this, God love her, she was an art teacher, you know, one of those classic overambitious art teachers. And this woman thought she was going to teach me to see color. She got me in front of the whole class with the color wheel. She spins the whole thing and she shows me each color. She says, okay, this one's yellow, this one's green. Got it, Eric? Yeah, this one's yellow, this one's green. Yep, Roger, we'll go that. Gotcha. Fucking does the wheel around again. Okay, which one's green? I point to the yellow one. And she's some reason astounded by this.
And it sounds like it's not even something malicious.
There's this total
disconnect.
Yes, 1,000%. It wasn't malicious in any way. It was just a so that was the thing. I really had to advocate for myself clearly and with little room for interpretation, because otherwise I couldn't get any help.
Yeah.
So in middle school is when I really learned to listen.
Yeah.
Like really, really listen. I'd always been tuned with my ears. Music was a huge part of my upbringing I could do a 10-part series on just that.
Yeah. Well, maybe not a 10-part, but maybe just for this episode, I want to know, because obviously, you know, being someone who relies so much on your ears.
Right.
And the audio is the world that you live in. I want to know, what was it like when music really came into your life?
I was really young, very young. I honestly would have to say it's attached to my earliest memories. My very first memory is sitting in a little daycare area of a gym that my mom was teaching aerobics in 1982. So we're talking Jane Fonda freshness here.
So how old were you then?
I'm two.
Two. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I got formative
memories at two.
And
for
I
us.
Got my big old Mr. Magoo glasses, my first round of Mr. Magoo glasses when I was two. And I had a little Mickey Mouse ball. I can remember it plain as day. And my mom was out there teaching aerobics to like some 80s pop. It was like, you know, just some 80s pop. And that beat, those beats. And it was funny when we were interviewing Concha, DJ Shambhala, and DJ Shambhala was talking about the Four on the Floor. The Four on the Floor is magic. You know, the number one song the day I was born was Funky Town. So it's like, you know, that disco funk, that beat, I feel like that's in my cosmic fucking genes. But, you know, my father is a trained pianist and he can play guitar. My older brother, when I was a child, played drums and tuba. My younger brother, who's 13 years younger than me, and we didn't even grow up together, he has an engineering degree from the same school as me. He plays guitar. He plays drums. He's a fantastic producer, great ears. So some of it, I think, well, I shouldn't say some of it. I would say a large part of it to me, it was in my genes. It was just that the vision thing unlocked it for me out of the gate. But the real first time when music kind of became my soulmate, and I say this because the very first girl that I was in love with, I'll spare her name in case for some reason she ends up on this. I cared for her very deeply. And when we had to separate, we were young and it was just like our lives had to go. And she said to me, good luck having a nice life where the only thing you love is music.
Oof.
And it was just like, oh, son of a. But to in large part, especially me at that age, she was right. Because the music really became a significant part of my life when my parents got divorced. Mm. And all of a sudden, the world that I saw as, you know, somewhat routine or predictable or whatever was gone entirely. And then it was a house where literally and figuratively one house is Beach Boys and the Beatles and the other house was Def Leppard, In Excess, Janet Jackson. I mean, we were getting it at Mom's. Yeah. And I remember when I couldn't really, when I was emotionally overloaded as a child, my defense was to always put myself in solitude somewhere with my Walkman or a boombox with batteries. I'd climb a tree. I'd go sit in the neighbor's driveway and play basketball with my boombox, playing David Lee Roth and Milli Vanilli and Bobby Brown. I mean, my taste in music as a kid was as eclectic as it is now.
Yeah, and I do, like, that was another one of the things we first really bonded over, because you're the only person I've ever met and really became friends with that listens to music as much, or I guess more than and wider than I do.
Well, I got 20 years.
Yeah, that's true.
I'll get there.
Yeah,
and then that's a huge part of my life, and there's nothing I'm more grateful for than the exposure that I had to art and music when I did in my small town.
Yeah,
it gave me the backbone to be who I am, and to make it so that curiosity doesn't die, and then everybody that sits on the other side of me here is like when I got my Bobby Brown tape. Like, I'm so excited to push play on the interview every time. Mm-hmm. And it's no coincidence that the line that I've come to, that I was not preconceived in any way, is I say to people, let's push rewind to da 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 da. The very first time I said that, I didn't think to say that. All of those subsequent times, up until it became routine, it wasn't. I just see things in that kind of continuum. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, obviously, music comes into your life really early and really strong.
Yes.
And you always have this deep connection to it.
100%.
Yet you kind of have this phase of your life where, you know, you think you're going to settle down, work at the movie theater in your town.
So, yeah, but see, I still got to play music there. Like, honestly, and this is one of those things that Keep the Hotel Empty is for me still as Eric, that kid from Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. When you live in a small town, and people out there in a small town can relate to this, I'm sure, you don't know how high the ladder goes.
Yeah.
Because no one comes back down to your rung and says, yo, dog, the ladder goes way up here, and it's actually way better up there.
Yeah.
So at the point in my life that you're kind of at, like, I'm really feeling like I'm at the top of the goddamn ladder. I'm good to go. I mean, I am good to go.
So what is the first time? Because, you know, we know that you ended up getting into production. Your dad tells you basically get off your ass, do something with yourself.
No, what he does is he plants the seed.
Yes,
because my dad knows me well enough. He's like, you're going to do something with yourself?
Right.
And it was like, well, fuck, if you put it that way, then now I have no choice.
So what's the first time, you know, you find that, oh, music has revealed that the ladder is a lot taller than I thought. And when do you start to climb it and start to get out of that, you know, small town, work at the movie theater, play the dive bars mindset?
Yes. That was my life, bro.
Yeah. When does that get rattled for you?
I can tell you when. It was 311 day. It was 311 day my first year in college, and I wore a 311 shirt to school. Because I love 311.
You're going to have to tell me what 311 is.
the band 311.
Okay.
I'm a huge fan of the band
311. You're going to send me some tracks.
Oh, man. I've been a fan of 311 for a long time. That's a whole other story. I can tell it a different time. And that's a whole other story. Became a huge fan of the band 311. And I didn't really have a lot of 311 fan friends. A couple. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And when I went to college, the only other 311 fan that I knew was my roommate. But he didn't go to college with me. So I'm all jazzed up. It's 311 day. And every 311 day back at that time, when it was 311 day, I'd get up in the morning, put on their first album, and literally listen to their catalog top to bottom. I mean, it was a thing for
me.
And I still celebrate 311 day. They're a big part of my music DNA. Any rate, I show up for my lab class. And in my lab class, we're working with one of the student bands. And the student was a gentleman named Quinn Kizo, who I just went and visited in Tennessee. And their band was called Flat, PHLAT.
Love that.
And I didn't know Quinn. We kind of had opposite schedules. I didn't know his band, anything about it. I'm still pretty green, and my head is firmly planted in my ass. And they come in, and they're kind of like a Chili Peppers-y, 311-y kind of band. And they see my shirt, and they're like, oh, cool, man. And I'm like, whoa, 311 fans? And so they did this EP, and... You know, I got to work on it just scantly in, you know, moving microphones and shit like that. It wasn't like anything like projects we were subsequently part of after that. But this was my first time, like, working with a band that wasn't in my dad's studios. Mm-hmm. And it was my first time working with a band where the band saw me as, like, a peer.
Yeah.
Because I was used to working with like older artists that were doing like Fleetwood Mac-y type stuff, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like nothing contemporary. So I worked with them and, you know, they knew me a little bit. And then, like most things would happen, they had the opportunity to get a bass player. And my life had been at that point solely a bass player. Well, and synth. I always did synth and keys too, because of my influence from my dad.
Sure.
But my first band was my two best friends who were drummers. One was a drummer and one was a guitar player.
Yeah.
So I had no choice.
Yeah. So you fit right into there.
Yeah. So I got a gig flat. Let me play a gig with them at a college in Madison, not UW-Madison, a different private school there. It was a really cool school that the drummer went to. And we played on a stage and there was college kids all around. And this was my first time not in a dive bar.
Yep.
And I was like, oh, shit. I was like, I can do this for real. I mean, the world is bigger than Staten Island, dog. I mean, it was right there at Edgewood College. We were playing basically for the bandmates, parents, siblings, and maybe 30 college kids. And then there was a bunch of people drifting around. But I was getting to wear my Ween t-shirt on stage, not in a bar. And I was just like over the fucking moon in every conceivable way.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, you mentioned something there that I kind of want to pick at a little bit. You know, you kind of started playing bass because that's what the environment needed, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like there's a really big power in stepping into a place and trying to see what areas you can grow into and fit. I have to imagine with your upbringing in life that concept is like supercharged for you. How much of your current skill and the skills that you've picked up along the way were just you being in a certain environment and deciding, I can figure that out. I can do this. I can do that.
Well, it's funny you should phrase it that way. My mom said that she never worried about me because she knew I'd always figure it out.
Like that's it. That's the key.
my secret to things, I think, is a lot what Dennis was talking about in the last episode, is just being adaptable.
Yeah.
You know?
100%. Because you had no choice.
Yeah, I really didn't have a choice. And, you know, I think everybody along the way gets those points where you're inevitably going to be intimidated to some degree. You're inevitably going to feel like, you know, you maybe bit off more than you can chew. This is a lot of the things I like to talk about with people when they're on the show, because the biggest gift that was given to me was my empowerment. So even when I had to feel like less than because I couldn't see, you can't not. It's the fact of the fucking matter.
Yeah.
You know, I still knew how to feel equally empowered.
Yes.
That's the operating part of all of this for me.
And you got to find a different path than everyone else.
And that to me isn't a negative.
Yeah.
And that to 100% me, not. That to me isn't even a taller order. It's mm-hmm. just a different order.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I'm really driving to share in this podcast with our diversity of guests, is like, lots of times when we feel like we got a tall order on deck, we really don't. It only seems that way. It's mm-hmm. just a different order. And
yeah.
if you can find a different way and not have to lament or feel bad about yourself or victimized in any way, that you couldn't take the easy way or shit just didn't go for you like it goes for everybody else or whatever, if you can completely negate that, then you can find yourself on the exact same square one that everybody else started at.
Because it's not always that you can't take the easy way. Sometimes it's just you can't take the same way that everyone else takes.
It's semantics. It's totally semantics. And as much as you wrap that shit up in your head, for anybody with disabilities, people who are full blind, not even just limited visual impairment, people who are full deaf, people who have disabilities of any range, they'll be the first ones to tell you that. But able-bodied people, just like, it's such a fucking radical concept to them because it's so rare in your lives that you have to experience that. You know, it's like, when I get hired at Sam Ash and I sell my first microphone and I got to go back into the store closet and grab the microphone, oh shit, these labels, they're all too small for me to read.
Yeah.
I didn't know to have a magnifying glass on me at all times then. I have a magnifying glass on me at all times now, but that's how I learned it. So at that point, I was like, what do I do? Well, my field of vision without my contacts or my glasses is literally about this much, like an inch and a half.
Yeah.
So I was like, standing in this storeroom. I'm like, I plunk out a contact, put my contact in my mouth, and start searching the microphone rack this far from the thing until I find the one I'm looking for. So it's not that, like, I'm so awesome or anything like that. It's that whenever you have any of those types of situations happen to you in life, you invariably learn to find a way, and you invariably become more confident in yourself. Because it was time where you could have been totally screwed and you weren't. You know what I mean? People find a way. And I think disabilities and people with disabilities are just like, they're just the first ones to know how possible that is.
Yeah. Uh-huh. They're the canary in the coal mine in a way. Yeah.
Yes. And I've often felt that.
Yeah. So I know that with your music career, like, a lot of that is, you know, there's months that have years within them.
For sure.
But I do want to kind of get maybe a flyover of kind of where music starts to take you from there. You're on stage, you know, for the, you know, the first time really feeling it. You got Ween shirt on and everything.
Yeah.
So that becomes something that you got to chase now, right? So where does that take you?
It was an ultimate dichotomy because I was in college to be a record engineer and record producer for myself.
Yeah.
And that was really my focus. And I was, despite being a high school dropout or expulsion, whatever category you want to put me in, I did quite well in college. And that's not something I talk about very often. And my idea was to be like my dad, in the sense that I can be entrepreneurial. I can open a studio. I can run the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I can do all the technical work. I can do all the clerical work. I'm business minded, and I can make my art, and the whole wheel will go around, and it'll be a thing of beauty. But then that's where the crossroads, the dichotomy came in. I started performing, and it was like, uh-oh. But I performed through my last year of college and still did exceedingly well in college, and I had that road in front of me. We were in our, what they called, career development. And I think I've told you this story, but I'll never forget this. And this is one that I'm sharing strictly because of the empowerment thing that I want this show to be.
Yeah.
We're going around our career development class, and I'm sort of teacher's pet big time. I've been teacher's pet for the most part, except for one or two. And they're going around the room and they're asking everybody where they're going to go work, because most people have either lined up an internship or they got a studio they already know they're going to go work at that's low enough level that they're going to hire them out of the gate or whatever. Or some people are going into media production and, you know, all that. And we've talked to TJ, Tristan Wallace, and Brian Dendy, both on this show. They were both products of the same environment, meaning they share a similar story to me here. And they're going around the room and they're asking everybody where they're going. Everybody's saying, I'm going to Studio A, I'm going to Studio B, oh, I'm going down to Chicago, oh, I'm going to Nashville, oh, I got an internship in L.A. And they get to Eric and they're like, oh, Mr. Frank, where are you going? And everybody's expecting me to say some studio, right? And I was like, they didn't say where are you going. They said, who are you going to work for? And I said, no one. And it was like crickets. It was like freaking crickets. And I knew I shit on the rug when I said that. And I was like, no one. And Susan, my professor who loved me, she looked at me. She's like, what do you mean no one? She's like, you better have a better answer than that. And I was like, no one. And she's like, what do you mean no one? And I was like, I learned all this stuff to put at advantage for me. I'm not going to go put all these skills to use for somebody else. You're out of your goddamn mind.
Yeah.
I didn't pay for this schooling to go give it to somebody else.
Yeah.
I mean, it just wasn't in my lexicon at all.
And I love that. That's definitely a parallel between you and I, which is how we ended up being friends. Watch the last episode for that one.
Yeah. Yeah, it just wasn't even on my fucking radar at all. Yeah. I was like, no, I'm not doing that. I did this to empower me, you nut.
Yeah, you got all these skills. Why am I going to go sell them to somebody else? Yeah,
that was naive. Don't get me wrong. But that was...
Yeah, of course.
I didn't. Yes. I didn't ever work for anybody in a commercial studio.
Yep.
I did run my own studio here. I revived Sarasota's oldest recording studio. I did plenty of freelance stuff. And, you know, ultimately that did turn out to be the way it went. But, you know, looking back on it, it was like, oh, man. You know what I mean? I had such tunnel vision. It was unreal. So when I graduated college, the band was doing well. I graduated in January because I had just kept rocking through school. And the band was doing pretty well. And it was dead-ass winter. So I was like, well, I'm not going to do anything now. You know, I'll just keep playing gigs, keep doing the thing. And then summer started to roll around, and it was like, okay, I can't plateau here. This is the theme of my life. I get scared of plateaus.
Oh, yeah.
Big time. And that's one of the things that I find really inspiring about this show and talking to all the people that we've talked to. It's routinely people exemplifying how the plateau is no place to be.
Yeah.
And no matter what you got to risk to get off it, life is risky. You're not getting out of here alive. That's one of my favorite quotes.
Yeah.
So I think even before I recognized that, I was sort of playing my hand in life that way. So I sort of blew up the band and moved to Florida the first time. And I'll never forget the last gig I played. It was in a big upstairs, beautiful old club in Oshkosh and playing with all my friends and our sister band who put us on and all these people, you know, coming out to give a shine because I'm leaving. And I'll never forget the guy that put us on. I mean, shout out Mice and Bones, Tim Rice. My music career would be absolutely nowhere without that guy. He decided to put Flat on bigger stages than what anybody else would, and we made good on it. And I'll never forget Mice sitting me down on the stairs in that club. God, this can make my voice crack. And I'm wearing a shirt and tie. I'm getting into that. I was always shirt and tie guy. No matter whether I was running a movie theater, rocking on stage, or doing this podcast, I'm a shirt and tie guy, unless I'm wearing a shirt that's cut into pieces. And Meissen sits me down and he says, Eric, you're a big fish in a small pond. And I said, yeah. And I didn't really like that being said to me, for starters,
because
it really put a point on what I wasn't happy about.
Right.
And he said, why do you want to give that up to be a little fish in a big pond? And I said, that's why.
Yeah.
That's why.
Uh-huh. Because the ladder keeps going up.
And that's what I didn't know at all. It was just something I felt in my bones that I had to find out. And when I first moved to Florida, dude, Sarasota was nothing like it is now. I was odd man out living on University. I didn't know anybody. The only gigs I could get playing bass were in Tampa, and of course I can't drive. But I learned a lot in that time here. But that was my break in my music career. And then just to give you the overview and tie this one together as quick as I can, I got really lonely here, and I didn't know really what to do with myself here. And I had a good Pro Tools setup. I was writing songs. I was trying to, you know, be creative and whatever, but I was on Lonely Dog Island, you know, DEFCON 1.
Yeah.
So I reached out to my music family in Wisconsin, and I said, hey, let's have a meeting about bringing two bands together and forming one. And the parties involved agreed to it. And then when I met in person with them, I said, okay, I'll move back from Florida under the agreement that in 1 year we're going to move to Los Angeles. And no matter where we're at with this band, we're taking it to L.A. And they all agreed to it. And we went through a year in Wisconsin. We got ourselves on the map pretty good. We got some good recognition. We produced an album because the singer and I both had engineering degrees. And we took the show on the road to L.A. And within the first 2 months of L.A., I got held hostage in a Taco Bell.
Yeah, talk about small fish in a big pond. Yeah. That's about the biggest pond for this that you can really find.
Yeah, and then I got jumped on Sunset Boulevard within a week after that. And, you know, but really the whole thing of it was we just didn't give a fuck. We were small town kids. We didn't know how to be nervous about being little fish.
Yeah.
We just were too excited. And when we got to LA, I got to tell you what, the band that we shared rehearsal space in LA came to see us in Madison before we came out there, because I think that they were mutual friends and we had some mutual friends. And I think their thought was kind of, oh man, I don't want these boys to come out to LA thinking they're going to survive here and they're going to get eaten up in a nanosecond.
Right.
Because they had traveled some of the same road as us. So they were good to determine whether or not we were going to run it. So they came to Wisconsin to see us, saw us at a club they used to play in Madison, Familiar Stomping Grounds, and I'll never forget, the notes were still ringing. Our set had not, I mean, we were still, the noise was still ringing on stage. And the drummer from that band that had come to see us came right up on stage, and he came right up to me, and he gave me one of those, like how your dad hits you on both shoulders, like, hey, kid.
Yeah.
And he kind of gave me one of them, hey, kids. And he looked at me, he's like, you guys are going to be just fine in L.A. And I was like, sold. I was like, you know, that put humongous wind in my sails.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So when we went to L.A., we really didn't know anybody. We didn't have any place to live. We literally parked the bus on a street in Hollywood, hopped out that bitch, and started going to every apartment around until one took us. I mean, my life, especially with the boys in Defino and Flat, was pounding the pavement and getting it done. And I'm forever grateful for them. And, you know, without people in your life like that, those things are exponentially difficult to do. With people in your life like that, they're exponentially easier to do and more rewarding.
Yes. And I was just going to say, like, you know, I think a lot of people today are kind of handicapped with technology in one regard, and plenty of others, but one that I can really think of is a lot of people forget the value of tangibly getting out and just getting it done.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, a lot of people think
boots
they can
on the ground, man. That still works.
100 boots on the ground.
Well, and that's
still
what
works
Brandon
the
best. Was saying. Yeah. That's what Brandon was saying about promoting for Fiends. We've had a couple other bands saying it. So don't I guess that is one of the other underlying themes of the show as well that I'm really thankful for is do not underestimate the human connection.
100%.
You know, we are in a little bit of a time of that, and I'm very grateful that the show can offer a little bit of a counterbalance.
Yeah.
To that.
And I think a lot of people felt like, you know, maybe the internet could be this magic bridge between from person to person. And we're kind of finding out that you still have to go and see a person face to face. And I think people now are wanting that more than ever.
Yeah.
And now it's like even more valuable than ever because we all tried to do just the social media thing. And then, of course, you know, we were all remote for a long time. And now people are seeing each other face to face again and realizing there's it ties into the whole like resurgence of what's the word I'm thinking of? Not acoustic, of not digital, the opposite of digital.
Analog,
thank you. Yes. People are reminded of the value of analog.
Yeah, and for me, it's like so instinctual, you know what I mean? Like, you know, to kind of bring it back to where's my curiosity come from? Well, I was brought up around people who were talkers. My grandfather was chief of police.
Yeah.
All people on the other side were entrepreneurs. I'm very used to talking to people, and I'm very much enriched by engaging with people. I'm one of those people who's like really introverted, but I love being social.
Yes.
I was at the Gibson Garage last week and I'm just kind of meandering around and, you know, there's not that many customers in there cause it was cold out that day. And I'm staring at a rack of customs. There's a Firebird, an Explorer, a 54 Les Paul that I want real bad. And, you know, a couple other, and a custom Flying V. There's just five guitars on this rack. And this guy walks past me. And, you know, we've been seeing each other in the store here and there. This guy walks past me and he said something to me like, like she's a beaut or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And this is me in a nutshell. And this is what I found out about myself more from this show. And maybe the thing that I've actually been good at this whole time I've spent my life as a musician or a creative or a record producer or whatever the shit I've been. Somebody's dad, too. I said to the guy, I was like, yeah, man, but I'm looking at this Explorer and this Firebird here, and I'm just really trying to figure out which one of these is actually more wood. I'm like, I think it's the Firebird, and it's actually deceiving because of its shape. And that's, you know, the sort of shit that I say, but yeah. Not the sort of shit that people generally say to each other unprompted.
Right.
But I'm just used to talking to people.
Right. And unprompted, people are more likely to say, yeah, it's a beaut.
Yeah.
And then go on their merry way.
Yes, but since I said that to the guy, he was like, you know what, man, I think you're onto something. And then we sat there and talked for a minute. Well, it turned out he's playing a show that I almost could have made it to that he invited us to. Turned out that we had mutual friend from the Chicago area. He's like very obscure mutual friend.
Mm-hmm.
And he's gonna be down here with this outfit that he's with playing in January. So we're exchanging phone numbers. I'm giving him the card for the podcast. And there's the introverted part of me that's like, who the hell are you? And then there's the other part of me that is infinitely curious and thrives on connecting to people. And of course, when guitars are involved, this is now on a whole different scale, but thrives on connecting to people. And I can't not do it.
Yeah.
I'm instinctively, for some reason, drawn to want to talk to people.
Absolutely.
And it took me 44 years to
realize
that out.
Yeah. yeah. So I want to kind of go back a little bit to the path that we were on here. What I'm curious about is you're in LA now. You're small fish in a big pond. You're doing all these things, the small fish in the big pond things.
Yeah, yeah.
What brings you back to Sarasota?
Oh, dude, that's actually a big, heavy one, and that's something that is a big, heavy one. I'll be as concise with it as I can. There's a lot of emotion involved there, and I can't hide it. And it was debatably one of the most significant things that happens in my life, so it's hard to couch.
Yeah.
But I can tell you this. Defino was the band that I was in. Defino was a reference to the Big Lebowski.
Mm-hmm.
We were huge Big Lebowski fans. We were family. We were family in that band. Still are. We're just all over the world now. And Defino was used to existing in our Wisconsin world where we're insulated and our creativity is inherently supercharged because of that. And people from small towns can always tell you that it's easy to be creative, or I shouldn't say it's easy, but it's definitely easier to find more obtuse creativity where there's less distraction.
Mm.
So we were very much used to being in a world where our creativity was constantly nurtured by no distraction.
Right. That's why a lot of bands put out great albums when they like lock themselves in a cabin.
Yeah, it's a good idea. It's a very good idea. At least for me it is. This is mixing records with my eyes closed. That, like you were saying before, when I do my last passes or I'm listening to a master or whatever, I close my eyes. Always. What were we talking about?
What brought you to Sarasota?
Okay, yeah. So as we're in LA, we're now rehearsing in this huge old textile factory, which is where a lot of the rehearsals take place in LA because it's just so densely packed. The downtown area, a lot of the old textile factories were fashioned into rehearsal spaces where there's like hundreds of rehearsal rooms in these spots, right? So now I'm rehearsing. I've gone from we were rehearsing in the cafeteria of a Jolly Green Giant food factory in Ripon, Wisconsin. No. It wasn't in Ripon. Shit, I don't remember but we were in the cafeteria of a Jolly Green Giant food factory that had a batting cage on train tracks. It was awesome. and now we're in this third story, big old room in this industrial complex. And I'm looking out at fences with razor wire and bums and strip clubs and all this shit. Like culture shock. The difference between Horicon, Wisconsin and Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, which is where we had all come from. And we lived in West Hollywood, California, and we rehearsed in downtown Los Angeles. There is absolutely zero similarities between any of those places.
Yeah.
Not a single one. Not a single one.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, because, you know, I definitely love big cities and I like to go to them often. But I have found when you get so many people together, maybe this is what you're feeling. There's something incredibly energizing about it and something that really sparks something unique in its own right. But there's also a sort of entropy to the human condition about it. And all the everything that makes people people is so highlighted, and all the bad shit is too.
Well, I feel like what big cities kind of showed to me in my initial stark onset was that there is a certain amount of altruism that is inherent once you have so many people together.
Yes.
But because of that, there is also a certain amount of seeing one another in a homogenized way.
Oh, yeah. Dude, last time I was in New York, I had this thought too. I spent quite a while, you know, just traveling, going in the subways to get from place to place. And after seeing so many faces, the faces all started to look like one face that everyone had.
Yeah.
And that's one of my favorite places in the world, but still.
Yeah, it's a weird schism between those things.
Mm-hmm.
But I loved it. I loved the big city. I absolutely loved it. I absolutely loved it. But the problem was to answer your question, the problem was it was way outside of what we were used to.
Yeah.
It was way outside of the things that had fueled us. So we started to be, I feel like me personally, I started to be exceedingly angular as a person as a way to accommodate the rigidness and unpredictability that happened at the same time in the world around me, and we were all learning so much.
Yeah, because you never know when you're going to get held up at a Taco Bell.
And this happened to me quickly.
Yeah.
You know, and I got jumped quickly, and those stories are stories in and of themselves, but in the context of this, it's more that these were starting to be entries in my book that weren't like anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And inherently, it started to shape the context of the book now. And it was doing that for all of us individually, and it was doing it to us collectively as a creative group. And I always say the music started to sound like our life was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our songs became, we always wrote long songs. It was always prog rock at its core, but our songs became longer, a little bit more dramatic. We were getting way more finite on the details of things. And sometimes that's just the progression in writing. But to us, and from me, especially with my perspective, and I think all of our perspectives, as producers of the content we were the artists for, we were keenly aware of the overarching things that were changing. And I think it was making everybody uncomfortable to some degree. And looking back on what made me leave LA, it shouldn't have made me leave LA. But this was a time when it was hard to get any outside input. We left LA and disbanded at the peak of my career.
Yeah.
Everything in the band was going better than it ever had. We were potentially on the doorstep of a European tour. I'm still to this day not more proud than any of those songs that we wrote at that time, and they've never seen the light of day.
Mm.
Just not necessarily because they were the most poignant pieces of music, but the struggle and the things that we went through to do them. But towards the end, it was really that everything was starting to be colored by LA. And as people who were free thinkers and free creators who colored everything around us, because the world around us was very Wisconsin.
Yeah.
To be colored by the world around us, for me personally, was very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Very uncomfortable. And it definitely started to make me more rigid as a creative person. It definitely made me less patient, and I was already not good with patience. It was making me a worse bandmate and a worse friend by every conceivable metric. And I remember sitting down with the band in our apartment saying to them, I have to leave this band. And we were all feeling this way. It wasn't just me. It was more that I was still the guy that I am now, where if everybody's got a mouthful, I'm going to say shit first. It's just, I can't not. And I remember saying, it's more important for me to keep my friends than it is for me to keep this band.
Yeah.
And that was what led me to leaving that part of my career as a professional musician, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
You know, my ambitions of being a professional musician. So I've always felt that my interconnectedness with people, which this show has been humongously rewarding in, is what is the most important thing for me to have in my life. If I'm going to do anything well, be a good person whilst I'm doing it and have fun at it.
Yeah. So I want to get you out of here. I'm going to give you a deep one and then I'm going to give you a fun one. Okay.
All right.
So for the deep one, I kind of want to keep picking at this, that what we've been on. You know, I've heard a lot of stories about your life and where you're at now, right? Transitioning into Keep the Hotel Empty and the podcast, I think a distinct shift is now this is different in that it's entirely based around highlighting other people.
Yes.
What do you think, A, makes that so important to you, being someone who has had this rich treasure trove of things that you've done for yourself and by yourself and with people? And what do you think makes you so good at it?
Well, the only thing that makes me good at it is other people telling me I am.
What do you think makes people feel that way then? Because everyone who comes in here says that you are an amazing interviewer.
Yeah, honestly, that's something that has kind of kept me up. Because the long story short of the podcast is this wasn't meant to be.
Right.
I was setting this podcast up technically, like the technical aspects of it, for other people to do.
Mm-hmm.
And they kept falling out of bed. The long story short as I can make it that you already know is when it finally came time for me to set up the set for us to do Keep the Hotel Empty, a picture fell off a shelf, hit me in the head, and severed a nerve in my hand. That put me back a whole nother year because of other health complications I was having at that time, too. And when it finally came time to do Keep the Hotel Empty, it was just like, well, everybody who's attempted to do a podcast in this scenario that I've set up for them to do, which I was just commissioned to do, wasn't like on me or anything, they had just fallen out of bed for. And I was like, well, I guess it's my time then. You know what I mean? I didn't really intend to do it.
Mm.
It was just like something I thought I could do. And since, to circle back to the opportunity, it was an opportunity sitting there that I was like, well, shit, I can't just leave it sit. You know what I mean? I can't just have this opportunity constantly be squandered. So now it'll be my turn. So when you agreed to do it, you know, I set up our first podcast with Fresco, and I recorded the first one, like you said, with two GoPros, an iPhone, and all pink lights I thought were blue. And I don't know why people have always had an okay time talking to me. And the only thing that I've ever been able to chalk it up to, and it's really something that I've tried to digest about myself over the course of this last year, because having all these strangers tell me that they've enjoyed speaking with me or found what I did to be something I did well is something that I've been taken aback by, because it wasn't something that I meticulously planted and got a 4.0 on, like my career as a musician and as a record producer. This was something that I straight out walked into dead zero preparation.
Yeah.
The only thing I can chalk it up to is the fact, and I don't even want to bring this up again, but I think it's the only answer I can come to. It's growing up disabled. Mm. I spent my whole life getting judged by people when they found out I couldn't see, because it immediately made it so I wasn't as good. I couldn't play basketball as well. I couldn't drive the car. I couldn't, you know, I hit the fucking wall sometimes. So, you know, it made it so I got right sick of being judged. And my mom taught me how to not feel judged. I actually, if people have a negative opinion of me, I'm okay with that. You know what I mean? And it's not like a bravado thing. It's the self-assuredness thing.
Right.
And
that's their problem.
I don't even know if it's anybody's problem, but I'm certain it's not mine.
Yeah.
You know, and that's because I've got a healthy sense of self. And that's really, really the thing. And it makes it so I've never felt the need to judge anybody. Never, ever. I don't care. I mean, this is something that, shit, I don't talk about it, it's going to make me seem like I'm fucking from 1950 and good old Dixie shit. But like, I didn't see another black kid until I was like 13 years old.
Yeah.
And the first African-American kid in my school was Lamar Woodard. And I loved basketball. And Lamar loved basketball. I didn't give a fuck if Lamar was fucking polka dotted. It was another kid that loved basketball.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget the first time I went to Lamar's house. It was like, you know, the only spot that had like assisted housing in my little town. And his mom looking at me like, what the shit are you doing here? But and me just kind of being like, but I don't know, just hanging out with yourself.
Am I not supposed to be here?
Yeah, I had no, and this is how I got held hostage in the Taco Bell for all intents and purposes.
Right, there's a double edge to it, I guess.
Yes, there is. When you feel like you can just be cool with people and that whole thought never crosses your mind, sometimes you end up in spots where people just ain't cool with you and you don't have a choice.
Right, right.
But that's another aside. But I just never had that air about me. So mm-hmm. No matter what's up with you, it's cool with me.
Yeah, and you know, I think people feel that when they first come in.
Yeah, and some of the people that we've had come in that have, you know, didn't know if they were going to get set up or for a takedown question or, you know, when I tell people I don't script any questions, I don't have an agenda, I don't have a political leaning, I'm not trying to get you to say anything, you know, I'm serious.
Yeah.
That's a real thing.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of people are just really taken aback by that for starters, but mm-hmm. then comforted in a way that they're not used to. And I'm humongously grateful for that because that's where the power of our interconnectedness lies. If mm-hmm. you can't trust me enough to know I'm not judging the words that are coming out your mouth, how are you ever going to share the things about you that could possibly really matter?
Yeah.
We have to be on a playing field where we're cool here no matter what, you know, and we've had some things along the way and some people that have expressed some certain judgments that I don't necessarily align with. But it's more that's okay and we can still have the conversation. And that's one of the things that some of our guests have talked about. We've silenced ourselves off a bunch. I'm all for having opinions. I'm all for being staunch, whatever you got to do.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm not for is not listening.
Yeah.
You know, I can listen to anyone. And I can take it one step further and I can listen to anyone gleefully.
Yeah.
I really can. And I don't know if I think a huge part of it's my disability and a huge part of it is also my audio training in that I'm trained to critically listen to things like we literally did critical listening exercises.
Yeah.
And I'm trained to find what I like about things. But when it comes to interviewing people, to come full circle with you and we get to the easy one, it's not about finding what I like about them. It's about finding what makes me curious, and that usually takes me all of half a second.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing that, you know, art in general is really good for, and this probably would have been a good answer to your question about reading. You know, when you look at something critically that you enjoy, it shapes a critical mind and a mind that's able to see the nuggets inside of something.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, hugely grateful for that.
Yeah. Well, I got to think of a fun one for you here. So, we've had a lot of people on the show.
Yeah, I think we filmed like 75 of them as of this filming.
Yeah.
Something like that, 75.
And you're my favorite guest I've had so far.
Oh, thanks.
My only one that I've had. We have a pretty eclectic mix of people.
For sure.
Where do you feel like we have gaps, and what would you be excited about? Like, what kind of person would be so different that you'd be really excited about getting on? What do you want to see that we haven't yet covered?
That's a good question. Well, I can tell you that the surface level one is I would like to speak to more people in the culinary industry.
Okay.
Because I love the parallel between cooking and any other art form.
Mm-hmm. It's not an art form that people usually think about when they think art.
Oh yeah, I do for instantly. I'm a cooking show nerd to the extreme because to me I'm watching people make records and make paintings. It's all the same and I geek out on it so hard. So I would love to have maybe we gotta get Isaac Johnson in here. Shout out Isaac Johnson. My boy Isaac, maybe we got to get him in here and start the chef thing. But outside of my own personal, who would I like to talk to for funsies? The type of people that I would really like to get, I would like to broaden into more, I would say, are people who have some horse in a theological race,
mm-hmm.
but aren't close-minded.
Yeah.
Because I'm very much interested in breaking down the barriers. And the easiest way to do that is to talk to someone who isn't like you, who isn't trying to make you feel like there's something fucking wrong with you.
Yeah.
So I would like people that, because I find that whether or not you have any horse in the race of theology or science or any of these things, like you said, we've had a very diverse group of guests in here, and I'm the lucky one. I've gotten to learn from all of these people.
Yeah.
I want more people to come in that can break down the barriers and help it so more people can end up lucky like me.
Yeah.
We got to want to hear from each other, and that's it. Whatever we're doing to do that is how we're moving forward.
Yeah. Amen. And brother, I definitely feel that too. It's been absolutely awesome the past a little over a year now getting to do this with you, and absolutely I'm the lucky one as well, because I get to be along for the ride and be a part of it and also get to hear all of these. It's been a lot of fun. I love this checkpoint that we've had, being able to interview each other here, and I hope that we get to do it again maybe when we're at episode 170 or so.
We'll do 150.
Love it.
You know, 2024 was the year of extreme gratitude, and we're rolling that right into 25.
Okay, love it,
extreme
man.
Extreme gratitude,
well, I'm
brother.
Extremely grateful for you, Eric.
Thank you, man.
Awesome.